Karno's hammer smashed it out of the air. The tiger went bouncing and rolling down the road in a cloud of dust. Karno appeared next to her. He grabbed her horse by the bridle and, with a display of incredible brute force, dragged the kicking animal down with one hand. Then he scooped up his hammer from the ground and turned back to meet the witch hunter, who had drawn his sword and was charging their way.
"I said ride!"
He smacked her horse on the rump. She started to run. Another tiger pounced. Rada had not seen this one coming at all, but Karno had. Its claws nearly sunk into her before they stopped inches away, seemingly frozen for an instant. Karno had caught it by the tail. She had enough time to see an almost human look of surprise on the beast's face before the protector spun it around and hurled it at the charging witch hunter. They collided violently, and the man and tiger both were sent hard to the ground.
"Yah!"
Rada shouted, though her terrified mare needed no urging. They ran through the grass, going wide around the crumpled form that had been hit with Karno's hammer, which was now in the shape of a gasping man clutching at his broken ribs, and then they bolted for Apura. Rada risked a look back over her shoulder, just in time to see the mob of horsemen appear, dozens of them, swords raised, their mounts whipped into a lather, thundering down the road in pursuit of her. Between them stood lone Karno, blocking the path.
Chapter 13.
"Faster! Go!"
Rada urged her mare as she imagined tiger claws sinking into her flesh at any moment. She didn't know who was more terrified, her or her horse. Karno was tough, but there was no way he could survive against so many warriors. And sure enough, once Karno was occupied, some of them went after her. She lowered herself in the saddle as Karno had taught her. Though she'd gotten a lot of riding practice in recent weeks, she'd never gone this fast before. Despite that, each time she looked back, the horsemen had closed more of the distance. Their animals were the muscled black animals of the desert warriors, and they were much stronger than her mare. When she looked again, her pursuers were close enough for her to see some of them wore gleaming, fanged masks.
Inquisitors!
The protector had distracted most of them, but the witch hunter had still sent five of his men to run her down. Karno had given her a proper dagger to use in case of an emergency, but she was no fighter. If they caught her, she wouldn't have a chance against one of them, let alone five. The city was near. Forests turned to pasture and farms. Instead of trees along the side of the road, there were low stone walls to pen in livestock. It was getting dark, but there were people on the road ahead, wagons of goods and farmers pushing carts, all of them heading into Apura, probably late arrivals to sell their goods at the festival. They didn't see her until Rada flew past them at a gallop.
"Sorry!" Men had to leap out of the way, spilling their baskets and bundles. "Excuse me!"
A cart overturned. Melons rolled as a woman cursed her.
"Sorry!"
She had an idea, and as she passed by, she reached out and smacked her hand against an ox's backside.
"Boo!"
That startled the drowsy animal, and in response it bellowed and lurched, pulling its wagon off to the side. The merchants rose off their seats to shake their fists at her. Luckily, the chaos she caused bought her some time, as the Inquisitors rode right into the snarl. They roared for the workers to get out of their way. Karno had wanted to avoid the travel checkpoints, but she was heading straight for one. There was no fancy gate on this road, just a small shack for the comfort of the warriors who manned it while they stamped papers and collected taxes. If she slowed down and tried to walk her way through, the Inquisitors would surely catch up enough to yell for the warriors to detain her. So all she could do was lay low, hug her horse tight, and hope that the road guards weren't alert enough to immediately fill her body full of arrows. The warriors were busy checking someone's papers by lantern as Rada flew right past them. One of them had time to shout,
"Hey, stop!"
But luckily he didn't throw his spear. There were three roads, so she picked the middle,
Or, more like, she'd completely lost control of her frightened mount, and she just kept running straight. They rode hard into Apura, and Radha hoped she would be able to put some distance between her and the checkpoint. Travellers had rushed to get out of her way. The crowd thickened. There were people everywhere. Men, women, and children. Her mare began to twist her head from side to side, suddenly blocked by bodies and unable to run.
"Damn drunken fool!"
an old woman shouted at her.
"Slow down before you trample someone, idiot!"
Someone had the audacity to throw a vegetable at her. It missed. Radha looked back. Lanterns were moving around the checkpoint. An inquisitor was shouting at one of the guards and gesturing wildly. Another inquisitor saw her atop her horse because she stuck out above the crowd, and he pointed and yelled for his companion's attention. She couldn't stay silhouetted up here, so Radha dismounted. "Run away, girl!" It filled Radha with despair to see the confused horse trotting off with her saddlebags containing most of her worldly possessions. But then she turned and began to push her way into the mob. All Radha had left was the rough-spun clothes on her body, the knife Karna had given her, and the satchel which contained her two most valuable things, the black steel Asura's mirror and her reading glasses. Though terrified, she knew she had to keep her head. It was escape, or the dome. The Inquisitors were heading her way. So Radha kept moving, pushing and shoving against men who were far heavier than she was. There were so many bodies pressed together here that the spring chill turned a damp warm. People were laughing, singing, and prancing about. A crowd of dancers created an opening for her, and she ducked between them, putting more bodies between her and the masks. There were so many people jostling around that her rudeness went unnoticed. The people of Apura were dressed much like she was, most of them in the simple garb of the average worker. But they were all stained with colours tonight. Brilliant reds, blues, greens and yellows. Radha gasped as she was hit in the face with a blue cloud. The pigment dust got in her nose and made her want to sneeze. She'd forgotten about that part of Holi. They didn't make a mess like this in the capital. Everything was bright and decorative there every day, and no first-caste woman would allow one of her fine silk dresses to be stained with indigo or turmeric. But Radha had read that the poor worker caste lived a drab existence mostly, so it made sense that their holidays would be extra colourful to compensate. The buildings in Apura were short by capital standards, only two or three stories tall, but they all had balconies. And on every balcony, someone was either playing an instrument or tossing handfuls of coloured pigment toward the ground. So much of the colourful dust had been thrown already tonight that the farther she pushed into the city, the thicker it became in the air. It hung like a pink swirling fog. And Radha was thankful for this small miracle, because it would make it much harder for the Inquisitors to see her. A parade of drummers was making their way down this particular street. The noise drowned out the shouts of the wolves snapping at her heels. Risking a glance back, she saw them, giving orders to the warriors they had just taken command of by virtue of their office. But she didn't think they saw her. They were easy to spot because of their terrifying masks, so their presence was drawing the people's attention. And then, fear. Unfortunately, as she watched, one of them shouted a command, and they all removed their masks. Now they looked like normal men and one woman. They would blend in, and she would never see them coming. Karno had told her to hide. The Inquisitors were brutal, but she was smart, and more importantly, educated. She'd once read a memoir about a Vokan spy's exploits in Vadal City, and she did her best to recall its lessons. She had to blend in. She could not attract the hunter's eye. On the road, the Inquisitors had seen a dusty woman dressed in a grey coat and desert scarf, so she wadded up her scarf and dropped it on the ground. Radha was of average height,
and Vidal women tended to be tall, so she didn't stick out that way. They wore their long hair down and loose, so she undid the band she used to keep her hair out of the way while riding and shook it free. Vidal women were renowned for their beauty, and in previous years that would have intimidated her, but due to her affair with Devadas, Radha had decided she was no slouch herself. However, it appeared all Vidal women could dance, twirling and swinging their hips with perfect rhythm. On that front, Radha was completely out of luck. Trying to emulate them would make her look like a clumsy duck among swans, so she just kept walking. Reaching an intersection of 5 points, Radha realized she needed to change her route. The Inquisitors would have to split up. She took the second right toward the city center, and luckily it appeared that street was even busier than the first. It was common for the youth of the worker caste to engage in water fights on Holi, and a big one was going on here. So Radha gladly stepped in front of the giggling children throwing buckets of colored water. They seemed rather gleeful that an adult would jump into their game. She was quickly drenched, half purple and half green, but with wet clothes, even more of the dry pigments were sure to stick to her. She'd be as camouflaged as the tigers had been in the forest. She glanced back, couldn't spot anyone following her, and kept walking. Radha was unsure how long she wandered, trying to disappear among the masses, but the farther she got from the violated checkpoint, the better. She passed by stands of delicious food, though so tempting earlier, now her stomach was so restless that the thought of eating made her nauseous. If found, she'd be taken to that most dark and terrifying place that loomed over the capital. The Dome. The shadow it cast on Mount Metoro warned everyone in the capital to behave, or else. There were tales of underground dungeons and torture chambers, and many who were summoned there were never seen again. The fear made her chest ache. She reached an open area, which on normal days must serve as some sort of park or city gardens, but during Holi it was filled with huge tents belonging to performers. Men stuck torches to their lips and breathed out balls of fire. Acrobats leapt, flipped in the air, and rolled on the grass. There was even an elephant which did tricks, and a tiny man who balanced upon its trunk. Between the noise and the colourful dust clouds, there should have been no way for the hunters to track her. She didn't see anyone she took to be an inquisitor. There were warriors, but they weren't searching for her. They were with families, relaxed and enjoying themselves. So Radha leaned against a wrought iron fence and tried to catch her breath. She'd not realized how hard her heart was beating. Karna had said that he would find her, except he was probably dead.
Oh no, Karna.
He was powerful, but there was no way one man, even a protector, could fight 50 warriors and survive. The first time they'd met, he'd knocked her down and set his hammer on her chest because he'd thought she was an assassin or a witch. But they'd become friends. The thought of him dying made hot tears come to her eyes.
Karna would not approve of tears. Get yourself together, Radha. What would that spy have done?
She couldn't get complacent, that was for sure. So Radha dried her eyes, wiped her nose, and kept watching for threats. Which was when she noticed the woman looking right at her. Everyone else was watching the elephant, the fire breathers, or the sword swallowers. The young men were watching the female acrobats. But this woman had definitely been studying Radha. There had been a female among the inquisitors. Was this her? It was hard to tell now because, like Radha, her face was also smeared with pigment. In her case, a ghastly red. Their eyes met. The woman didn't look away. Instead, she began walking toward Radha with great purpose, roughly shoving children aside. Radha pushed off the fence and began walking along the park. The woman walked faster. Radha increased her pace. So did the woman. Radha ran. The Inquisitor gave chase. Radha fled as swiftly as she could, but she was a librarian, not an athlete, and the Inquisitor closed the distance quickly. Watching her pursuer instead of where she was going, Radha crashed right into someone. Since he was so much heavier than she was, physics made him stumble, but put her on the ground. She'd bumped into a warrior, and this one wasn't here to celebrate, but was rather obviously on duty. He was wearing armor, the steel plates painted that distinctive Vidal grey-blue, and intricately decorated with rings of bronze. He wore no helm, but had a spear in one hand, which he carefully kept upright so as to not poke the crowd. A look of mirth crossed his face.
"Careful! I know the acrobats are a sight, but don't break your neck."
There were two other warriors right behind him, similarly armed and dressed. Radha didn't know much about their caste, but their armor was artful, more like what you'd expect to see in the capital than some common place like Apura. These were men of status, or, more likely, servants of a man of status. Radha saw that the Inquisitor was nearly there and quickly blurted, "Help me, warriors! A fiend is trying to murder me!" The man she'd bumped held out one hand to help her up. He hoisted her from the ground. The expression on his handsome face indicated that he thought this was all some manner of holiday-related foolishness.
"How much have you drank tonight, girl?"
But one of his companions was more alert. This one was older, with a scar that split his chin, and he recognized Radha's genuine fear. His eyes quickly snapped up, scanning for threats. He spotted the oncoming Inquisitor and put one hand over his sheathed sword.
"Halt!"
The red woman stopped.
"Turn her over to me," she demanded imperiously. "Now!"
The Inquisitor sounded so used to people immediately doing as she commanded, she must have forgotten that she wasn't wearing her mask.
"What's going on here?" asked the first warrior.
"She's a maniac trying to kill me," Radha exclaimed.
The older warrior glanced between the two women and then snapped at the third warrior.
"Warn the palanquin there's a disturbance I must investigate."
That soldier immediately complied and ran off, armor clanking.
"This is none of your business, warriors,"
the Inquisitor snapped. The handsome one standing next to Radha must have still thought that he'd interrupted some worker's spat.
"If it's in the borders of Great House Vidal, then it is our business. So watch your tone, woman."
"Identify yourself,"
demanded the older, because he recognized from the Inquisitor's bearing that she was no mere worker. Radha hurried and answered before the Inquisitor could.
"I'm Senior Archivist Radamanta Nemzdar Haban of the Capital Library, and this woman is an assassin."
Either these warriors were exceedingly devout patrons of the library, which she doubted, or they were particularly sensitive to the accusation of assassin, because their reaction was immediate and extraordinary. The handsome warrior shoved Radha violently aside, and in the same movement his spear whipped around aimed at the Inquisitor.
"Wait!"
said the Inquisitor, and she raised her hands, revealing that she had palmed a stiletto, and had been keeping the long, thin blade concealed among the inside of her forearm.
"Knife!"
At the sight of the readied weapon, the handsome warrior punched his broad spear right through the Inquisitor's chest. There was an odd look on the woman's face, almost dumbfounded, as she was shoved back until she hit the fence. With a brutal twist, the spear was wrenched free. She tried to say something, but only blood came out. She went to her knees, then flopped over on her face to lay there, limp. Radha cringed. It wouldn't just be powder staining the streets tonight. The party around them had paused as the revelers realized something had gone horribly wrong. Then they saw who had done the stabbing, and that the victim looked as low status as they were, so no one said a word of complaint. They either went about their business, or stopped to gawk. Rada felt something cold against her neck. Cautiously, slowly, she looked down to find that the older warrior had her on the end of his sword.
Not a word until my superior arrives.
He said that to her, but his eyes were nervously flicking over the rest of the crowd.
There's nothing for the rest of you to see here. Move along.
Rada didn't dare nod, because she feared she'd cut her own throat. These warriors were clearly not the hesitating type. The younger one used his boot to nudge the knife away from the dead Inquisitor's hand.
The edge has been coated in something green and oily. Poison for our charge, most likely. That's a weapon for quiet murder, if there ever was one.
Rada knew that they wanted her alive. The poison was more than likely a drug to cause sleep or befuddlement, and the Inquisitor had intended to prick her with it so they could sneak her away without notice, as she'd read about in her Book of Spies. Not that she was going to tell them that, for the presence of that substance seemed to confirm to the warriors that they'd done the right thing. The young one used the butt of his spear to roll the body over and knelt down next to begin checking through her clothing.
Careful, said the elder. If she's one of the assassins we've been warned about, she'll have demon on her.
No, but I've found travelling papers.
He was near a pole where an oil lamp hung, so he held the stamped forms out to better read.
She's from the capital.
Then he went back to searching, and his face fell.
Oh, this is not good.
What?
He held up an Inquisitor's mask.
Salt water!
The old warrior flinched so hard, Rada felt the sword edge rub against her neck.
How was I supposed to know? She was acting like a threat. I was doing my job.
Do you think they're going to care? Hide that thing before anyone else sees.
The young one hurried and stuffed the mask beneath his arm. It was probably a futile gesture, since, despite the admonition for the crowd to move on, quite the opposite had happened, and more people were coming closer to see what was going on. When they'd seen the mask, they began to mutter. Inquisitors were feared, never loved, but pity the poor bastard who angered that order. The way she was being held at sword point, Rada figured everyone would assume she was a criminal. If she wasn't so worried about her imminent murder, she'd have been rather indignant about that. Rada noticed a familiar face coming through the crowd. It was the witch hunter, Koja. He was walking with a limp, and was also stained red, though she feared this wasn't from powder, but rather the blood of noble Karno. The fact the Tiger Man was alive didn't bode well for the safety of her friend. Koja saw the dead Inquisitor, and a look of fury came over his face.
Rada knew she was doomed.
Here he comes, the senior warrior warned.
But he wasn't talking about the witch hunter. He was looking in the opposite direction. The spearman moved away from the body and stood at attention. She could tell Koja wanted to snatch her by the hair and drag her from this place, but he stopped, obviously fuming, but not possessing the prideful stupidity of his predecessor. He pointed at her with two fingers, elbow bent, then mouthed the words so only she could see. She thought the message was, "You are mine," but she supposed it could just as easily have been, "You are dead." Rada couldn't really read lips, but either way the message was bad. A great excitement went through the assembly. There was a rapid spread of awed and fearful whispers such as,
It's really him.
And mothers warning their children,
bow your head.
Radha was afraid to turn. But out of the corner of her eye, she saw the colourful crowd parting and more warriors in the same ornate armour approaching. Behind them was a magnificent palanquin carried on poles by 8 burly workers. The curtains of embroidered silk had been pulled aside so that the rider could enjoy the spectacle of the festival while remaining in complete comfort and relative isolation. With a word from their master, the workers stopped and then gently lowered the palanquin's hardwood and carved ivory compartment to the cobblestones. The armoured warriors spread out, forming a protective circle around it. The man who got out was truly notable, wearing the finest robes of the capital and a sash of Vidal grey. Around his neck was a chain bearing a ruby the size of a baby's fist. He had a neatly trimmed beard, gone just enough grey around the edges to make him look distinguished and wise. He lifted one hand, every finger bearing a golden ring, and waved at the crowd. They all bowed. Radha could tell that half of them adored him and the other half were scared of him, and that seemed to make the man happy, for he smiled at the people of his house like a patient father and gestured for them to rise. Radha recognized this man, for she'd heard him speak in the Chamber of Argument. He was supposed to be one of the greatest orators in the history of the capital, though she had no ear for such things. Any important new change to the law she'd filed at the library, odds were his signature had been upon it. Her father, who followed politics rather closely, believed him to be one of the favourites to be obligated as the next chief judge. While Devadas had warned her that he was a venomous snake, never to be trusted, for though he couldn't prove it, Devadas believed that this man had been part of the conspiracy to conceal Ashok Vidal's true identity from the world. It was Harta Vidal, the Thakur and ultimate ruler of Great House Vidal.
Greetings, Apura!
The crowd went wild. Love him or hate him, it was rare for people in a place like this to actually lay eyes on the man who quite literally owned their lives. Their Thakur's presence was obviously unexpected. Harta had the orator's ability to speak from the chest, to make his words clearly heard, even though all around them the city was still filled with music.
It has been my great pleasure to partake of your hospitality this holy. Apura is one of the finest cities in all of Vidal, the most blessed of all the great houses. Let it be known that I am proud to be your leader.
They cheered.
Thank you. Thank you. Return to your festival and know that Great House Vidal loves you, that I, Harta, love you.
As the cheering continued, Harta walked over to the warrior who was still ready to slay her. He lowered his voice and went from pleased to annoyed very quickly.
What's all this, Jirish? I was told of an assassination plot against me.
Luthra and I were approached by this one here, claiming to be the first caste, my lord. She warned that the other, the dead one there, was an assassin. When she flashed an assassin's blade, Luthra dispatched her. I knew I was right to increase the numbers of my personal guard.
Harta scowled at Radha.
Who are you supposed to be?
Senior Archivist Radamantha Nems Darhaban of the Capital Library, Your Honor.
Nems of the Library? Dormad's daughter?
Harta snorted as he looked at her purple-stained face.
Bloody unlikely. I was told the daughter of Dormad is a charming young lady of breathtaking beauty.
She was sopping wet, covered in clumping dyes, atop clothes filthy and stinking from travel. But still, Radha had to try really hard not to take offence at that.
That would be my sister, Daksha. But you've seen my name. I'm the one who prepared the report for the judges about the legality of casteless genocide.
Ah, yes. Harton nodded thoughtfully. I do recall that particular Nems now. The way he said that, however, Rada didn't know if it was a good thing or bad.
There's, one problem, my lord.
The younger warrior, apparently called Luthra, came over and handed his Thakur the dead Inquisitor's mask.
This was upon the dead woman.
What? Harta took it in his hands, brows furrowed, and he stared at it for a long time.
She wasn't wearing it when I killed her, I swear.
This particular order is already a source of great consternation for me. You'd better hope this is a forgery, Luthra. And that was the precise moment that the witch hunter Koja decided to approach.
It is no forgery.
He had put his own golden mask on, accentuating his fearsome office and hiding his face from the people he was supposed to spy on. Some of the warriors protectively stepped between their Thakur and the witch hunter.
What do you want?
Harta asked, sounding bored. Koja bowed in the northern style, respectfully low.
We are in pursuit of a fugitive.
Her?
Harta asked incredulously.
Is the library supposed to be a hotbed of rebellion now? If so, no one informed me.
No, noble Thakur, it is her alone.
While the last who tried to take her had used threats and bluster, Koja used honeyed words. The death of my associate was an unfortunate misunderstanding. She was after this fugitive and meant you no harm. Though I can understand why your guards reacted as they did. These things happen, and I will be sure to personally tell the Grand Inquisitor that the personal guard of Great House Vidal did absolutely nothing illegal.
Oh, really? How magnanimous of you.
Harta's words dripped with sarcasm. Koja's mask hid his expression, but Rada suspected he was grinding his teeth.
The librarian has been summoned to the dome. She needs to come with me.
Interesting. And why does the spider Amand require her in his web?
Koja paused. It must have been rare for him to find someone brave enough to openly speak ill of the Grand Inquisitor. He was probably used to being able to push people around, but nobody pushed around a Thakur inside the borders of his own house.
Apologies, Your Honor. The Grand Inquisitor's reasons are not mine to question. I merely fulfill my obligation and do as I am told.
Harta studied Koja for a moment, and then looked back to Rada.
You don't look like much of a heretic.
Rada spoke carefully, because the old warrior, apparently named Jirish, had not yet removed his sword from her throat.
I've done nothing wrong. There is a conspiracy among the Inquisitors to break the law and lie to the judges and...
Enough!
Harta held up one hand. He thought it over for a moment.
Lower your sword, Jirish.
Rada took a deep and thankful breath after the steel departed.
Please, Lord of Adal, it is of utmost importance that I return this fugitive to the capital. I was just in the capital myself recently. I'm on my way home because there's business which requires my personal attention in Vidal City. It is by happenstance that we stopped in Apura to rest for the holiday. But since I am here...
Set my mind at ease, Inquisitor. If this woman has been summoned to the dome for questioning, then surely you have the proper paperwork to show me. I am curious to know which of my fellow judges signed this warrant.
Koja was silent for a long time.
Apologies. I do not have that on my person. Unfortunate. The Inquisition cannot just snatch a member of the highest caste off the street without a warrant. That would be unseemly. I've heard rumors of Armand doing such things in recent years, but I had always dismissed such claims as outlandish rumors. Surely the Grand Inquisitor would not do something so clumsily illegal. The masked man had no response. Rada doubted the Inquisition had ever used any such official thing. That was why at first they'd sent bounty hunters after her in Zarga. I'm afraid that as Thakur and supreme arbiter of the law in this land, I would be remiss in my duties if I allowed the Inquisition to trample upon the rights of our visitors. Convey to your master that I will take this Radamantha, is it? I will take her into my custody. Once Armand gets his paperwork sorted out, he may officially send for her. She will be a guest at my estate in Vidal City. You are dismissed. Harta began walking away.
You are making a mistake, Koja shouted. I obligated an entire palton of Zargar warriors and have tracked her for weeks. The Inquisition will remember this.
Harta stopped. Back turned. But from the hunch of his head and the way his hands clenched into fists, it was obvious that the witch hunter had just crossed a very dangerous line. Koja hadn't just called him out, but he'd called him out in front of his witnesses. Regular people who would surely talk. When Harta looked back, the smiling orator was totally gone, replaced with a steel-eyed ruler. The first kind gave flowery speeches. This one ordered men killed.
I am Thakur here. Thus I cannot make mistakes. Anything I say becomes true because of the act of my saying it.
Koja must have realized he'd gone too far. He glanced furtively to the side, and Rada noticed that a few of the gathering watchers might be the Inquisitors who'd been chasing her. Was this witch hunter bold enough to challenge a Thakur? Luthra must have noticed that a few of the people in the crowd were acting out of place, because, with a nod of his head, another armored warrior moved in that direction to block them. Harta travelled with a seemingly immense number of bodyguards, not to mention there were many regular warriors here as well who would gladly leap to their Thakur's aid. The Inquisitors would be ripped to shreds.
What's more, you brought Zargar dogs into Vidal. Which of my foolish arbiters signed off on this incursion?
When no immediate answer was forthcoming, Harta said,
I thought so. Jirish, summon the local garrison. Have them find these desert scum and annihilate them. Hound them to the border. Do not stop the chase until they cross it, and then notify the Thau, who I am sure will be equally as furious about the Inquisition casually bringing illegal invaders into their lands. Yes, sir.
Did you hear that, Inquisitor? The festival will buy you some time for my warriors to assemble. Consider that your head start. You are lucky I have such great respect for the law, or I'd just have you killed here and now. Koja, knowing that he was defeated, gave Harta a small bow and then walked away. Many of the locals, having overheard this exchange, started to boo, and then the drunker ones began throwing fruit and even rocks at the retreating Inquisitor. They seemed gleeful about it, too. It was as if the presence of their offended Thakur granted them temporary license to mock an organization they were terrified of, and the chaos of the colorful crowd gave them the anonymity to get away with it. Rada felt an emotion somewhat akin to relief, but only briefly, because then Harta grabbed her roughly by the arm.
Come.
I was traveling with a friend, a protector, when they attacked. He might be
dead or captured.
I don't care, Potter snapped as he shoved her toward the palanquin. All that matters to me is that for a man to be so braven, you must be very important to him. But he's not the only one who can play the great game.
If the Grand Inquisitor wants something so badly, then that is reason enough for me to take it away.
You are property of Vidal now, librarian.
Chapter 14. It had only been a day since Thera had commanded Ashok to go to war. She'd not expected him to conquer a town already. The so-called Voice of the Forgotten had been sitting next to a humble campfire made of old grass and dried dung when her so-called general had ridden up on a giant white horse to deliver his full report. If the story had come from anyone other than always truthful Ashok, she might not have believed her ears. The castless quarter of Dakantar spared, 3 paltons of warriors utterly defeated, 20 hostages taken, including the Fonto of the Chakma garrison, and the sons had only sustained minor injuries in the process. Thera had never led an army before, but her father had led many, and she'd practically memorized all his stories. The idea of what was basically a small raiding party crushing 3 paltons without losing a single man wasn't just unrealistic, it was absurd. As Andaman Vane had always taught her, no matter how good you were or how lucky you were, bad things happened in battle. A group of warrior castoffs, workers, and swamp men who'd never ridden horses before shouldn't have been able to take on a superior force at all, let alone win. And without great cost, impossible. Keita would surely give all the credit to the gods, but Thera needed to know what had really happened.
How?
Surprise. Terrain that favored us. And a prideful adversary, Ashok said as he dismounted. One of the workers immediately rushed up to take the reins from him. Take good care of this animal. Make sure he is cleaned and fed. He did well today.
Yes, General.
Thera still couldn't get over how eager the religious fanatics were to serve anyone their god hung a title on.
Only Ashok had spent most of his life as one of the highest status men in the land, so he was probably used to such things. Though right then he didn't look like any first-caste man, being filthy, covered in dried dirt and matted blood, and stinking of sweat, both his and the horse's.
It appears our numbers have grown, Ashok muttered as he looked across her mob.
We've been coming across refugees all day, castless who fled ahead of the warriors and to murder them.
Most of the newcomers were thin, sickly, and weak. Some of them had hacking coughs. Many of them were weeping or in shock because their loved ones had just been put to the sword over recent days. It was a motley bunch. Ashok just scowled. She knew what he was thinking. This was a lot of slow feet and hungry bellies.
They fell in with us. What else was I supposed to do, turn them away?
He had only just arrived, but already those who'd come from the swamp were telling the newcomers about how the man before them was the mighty Fall. It was long after sundown, and everyone in their hasty camp who hadn't been given some other pressing duty began gathering around the fire to hear their returning legend speak. Only Ashok didn't seem to care for their attention. Instead, he sat down on the ground next to her and simply said,
I need food.
One of the women they'd freed from the House of Assassins immediately rushed to ladle him some stew from the kettle placed over the fire. The magically befuddled slaves still didn't communicate, but they seemed eager to serve when given the opportunity. If this camp was to survive, everyone would need to pull their weight. So even though it made her feel guilty to do so, she'd ordered them to work. They were rather proficient at preparing food and caring for the livestock, which made sense, since that was what their wizard masters had forced them to do. The slave gave Ashok a bowl of their stew, made from every edible shoot, mushroom or root they'd come across, and any animal that had been unfortunate enough to blunder into the path of their column that day. It was hearty, but Thera didn't know how long that would last. Ashok stared into the fire as he ate, the exhaustion plain on his dirty face. Even the strongest man could become worn out. Thera passed Ashok a jug of water that had been resting next to her knees, and he immediately gulped down half. Then he stopped, ever practical, and asked,
"What is our drinking water situation here?"
"Plentiful. There's a clean stream nearby."
"Good."
Then Ashok dumped the rest of the jug out over his hair and used his least dirty sleeve to try and scrub the caked blood from his face. It made a small difference. Then he looked across the crowd of curious and hopeful faces.
"What are they staring at?"
"Their hero," Thera explained, "who the gods sent to avenge them."
Ashok snorted. She thought it was absurd, too, but if the belief kept these castless orderly, she'd use it. Thera had spent the whole day's march worrying that in her anger she'd sent Ashok and the sons off on a mission of certain doom. Seeing the scene of that massacre had infuriated her, but as her calm had returned, she'd begun to think through all the terrible ramifications of her hasty command. Yet it seemed none of those worries had come to pass. If Keita was here, surely he would proclaim this as a sign that the gods were really on their side, as he did every stroke of good fortune, which usually sounded like childish superstition to her. But frankly, for this, she didn't have a better explanation. Ashok continued his report between spoonfuls.
"We ran all night, assaulted a camp, rode all morning, and fought a battle. The sons needed to rest. They've taken the warriors' encampment outside Dakantar. I left Eklavier in charge and warned Sekar not to loot the town. Looting seemed inappropriate. I returned alone to warn you."
"Warn me of what?"
"We were lucky today. The warriors did not expect such resistance in their own lands. They will not make this mistake again. A great many warriors escaped. Word will spread. Now that they know there's an enemy force here, they will be searching for us."
As if to accentuate the dire situation, Ashok pointedly glanced around the camp.
"A group like this will be easy to track, easy to find, and far too slow to evade pursuit. It will take several days for the great houses to get word, and a few more to mobilize all their forces. But after that, the whole army of Akashan will come after us."
His grim assessment delivered, Ashok put the bowl to his lips and began to shovel in food. "I thought of that after I sent you off to provoke the entire warrior caste." Thera wasn't the type to sit and fret about problems. As a criminal, she'd needed to think fast to stay ahead of trouble. She tried to tell herself this was similar, only now she was planning for a great number of people rather than just herself. Small gang or big gang, same principles, just with more potential executions if she mucked it up.
"Do you have any ideas?"
"Out of our whole band, we had one man with a head for military tactics, and Jagdish is walking back to Vidal beside a fat merchant and a donkey train full of demon parts. So in his absence, I asked myself, what would Jagdish do?"
Ashok shrugged, as if to say he wasn't sure either, and continued chewing. Thera continued, "We need to get these people back to the hideout, but without the Akashani following us and finding the secret entrance. Only this many feet leave quite the trail, and the way this damnable grass bends, even a blind man could follow us. Normally, warriors wouldn't bother with a column of castless refugees, which is surely what our sign will look like. But according to that injured man you found, the warriors are supposed to hunt all the castless down, every last one of them."
"The letters I found in the defeated camps confirm that all of them are to be exterminated. It seems your rebellion has greatly angered the capital."
Ashok must have been starving, because he handed the swiftly emptied bowl back to the woman who was still waiting to serve him and said,
"More."
"But the rebellion is how we're going to slip away. You know what leaves a bigger trail than us?" When Ashok didn't immediately answer her riddle, Thera proudly declared, "Cows."
"I do not understand the significance of cows."
"Of course you wouldn't. First casters never have to concern themselves with mundane things like where their food comes from. Keita told me of a family of fanatics who live near here, worker caste, but secret believers in the Forgotten. They are drovers, and occasionally supply the rebels with meat. This land doesn't have much besides grass, but it's great for grazing. And the workers here move vast herds of cattle back and forth as they eat down the grass. They winter them on the plains, but it's normal to move them up to the mountain valleys to feed after the snows melt. That's the direction we're heading."
"You intend to order the cow people to drive their animals behind us to obscure our passing?"
"I don't know much about cattle, but they're hardly graceful. All that stomping and pooping is sure to obscure our trail."
"This seems reasonable." Ashok nodded. "Clever."
It was interesting that when dealing with a man who was so frugal with praise, when praise was given, it meant more.
"Thank you, Ashok."
He paused, inhaling his stew long enough to say,
"But it will not be enough."
"What do you mean?"
"Hooves may destroy your tracks, but not hide all these bodies from the eyes of a scout. After suffering a defeat at the hands of such low-status foes, every warrior in Akashan will be offended and eager to avenge this insult. The plains are big, but not big enough to avoid them for that long."
Ashok leaned forward and used his finger to draw on the dirt.
"We are here. The Sons are here in Dakantar. That's where the warriors will be converging. But they'll have a large number of scouts roving ahead. You need to head west toward the mountains, but there is no way you'll make it past unseen. However, if I take the Sons to threaten Chakma, a valuable prize, it will surely draw the warriors' attention, and your path will be clear."
Thera frowned. His plan made sense, but it also placed the Sons and Ashok himself in great danger.
"I don't think it's wise to split our forces again."
"Understandable. You'll need the Sons to protect this mob. Then send me alone. I should be a sufficient distraction."
Thera looked at Ashok like he'd gone mad. After all that they'd been through together, was he still trying to kill himself to be free of his obligation to her? She started to snap an angry response, but then realized that there were a great many eyes on the both of them. To these people, they weren't Ashok and Thera, fallible individuals who got tired and made mistakes. They were the Forgotten's warrior and the voice of the gods. And many of these people had just fled from their homes, narrowly avoiding death. They'd lost everything they had, and members of their families too. All they had left was faith in their cruel and illegal god. So the last thing they needed to see was his representatives bickering.
"An interesting idea, General. But let's discuss this privately so we can seek the wisdom of the Forgotten to see which way he wants us to go."
Ashok gave her a curious look. He knew very well her low opinion of the voice and its wisdom. Of course he didn't understand her desire for privacy, because he'd probably spent even less time considering their followers' feelings than the feelings of their supposed gods. But she was his sworn master. So he said,
"Very well," and stood up.
The two of them walked away from the fire and out into the tall grass, until she was certain they were far enough away nobody would be able to overhear, even if she got angry and raised her voice.
"You'd go to Chakma by yourself? Are you truly that desperate to be rid of me that you'd rather commit suicide?"
"Dying is not my intent."
"It's the most likely outcome. You don't have your magic sword.
You're not a one-man army anymore, and you said yourself how angry the warriors are going to be. It surprised her that it was Ashok who ended up raising his voice.
Then you should have thought of that before you ordered me to attack them. Blood has been spilled, Thera. I can't stuff it back in their veins.
I know.
She looked up at the sky full of stars and sighed.
You're right.
The two of them stood there for a long time, quiet. It was still cold, but the wind had tapered off to a slow breeze. Kanda was full, and its white light gave the endless sea of grass an almost fuzzy glow. The second moon, Tiny Upagraha, was barely noticeable, making its swift line across the sky. Back in the camp, a child laughed. It was an odd sound, considering their circumstances, but it just went to show that moments of happiness could be found in the strangest circumstances. It would have been a nice night, if they weren't drowning in troubles.
I volunteer, not because I wish to die, but because it is my duty to make sure you live.
She believed him, and though it made her feel worse to recognize the truth, it made her feel better to hear him say it.
There's got to be another way.
In the morning we will rendezvous with the Suns. Perhaps we will come up with a better plan by then.
Surprisingly, it appeared that Ashok was trying to comfort her.
In the meantime, do not regret your command to avenge the dead Castless, for it saved many lives today. The Castless Quarter in Dakantar would have been slaughtered if not for you. They will probably still die before this is over, but for now they have a chance.
He may have been trying to comfort her, but he was terrible at it.
I never wanted to decide who lives and who dies.
Ashok nodded.
When you are a leader, it falls on you to make difficult decisions. My swordmaster always told me that every choice has consequences, but once committed, you must see it through. Hesitation leads to defeat.
Ritual told me basically the same thing.
It had come as quite the surprise, during a conversation back in the swamp, when they'd realized the same man had instructed both of them. Ratul had taught one of them how to be a protector, and the other how to be a prophet. It was odd how the same man could teach both the most legal and the most illegal trades in the world. Though Ratul had much more time to teach Ashok, and much better luck getting his lessons to stick, than he had with her. At times it seemed like Ashok was the paragon of relentless perfection, while Thera felt like she was drowning in water over her head, blundering about, trying to survive, clumsy as her scarred-up hands.
He was a maniac, but with good advice. Sometimes.
Good old Ratul,
Thera muttered.
Good, Ashok snorted. He was anything but good. That crazed fool kept it a secret from the entire Order that he thought the gods were whispering in his ear. Then he found you and abandoned the law to help a rebellion.
And now you've taken his place. So who is the crazy one?
Ashok just shook his head.
The gods do not whisper to me.
Though on occasion they shout.
It pained her to show weakness to anyone, especially to him, but it needed to be said.
Listen to me, Ashok. I need you. I need you with me.
Do you say this as the prophet, or as a woman?
She couldn't discern his expression in the moonlight. Amid all this suffering and strife, deep down, did he also wish for a normal life? Was he even capable of such thoughts? Or was that just her own wishful thinking? And in that moment, Thera hated herself for being weak and for briefly allowing herself to have dreams.
Either. Both. It doesn't matter. I've survived a lot on my own, but I can't do this. We were both forced into these roles against our will. But here we are. It is what it is. These people are counting on me. I'm counting on you to get us to the cove. There we can be safe. For a while, at least. Even as she said it, deep down Thera wondered if the gods or the law would ever grant them that small mercy. Chapter 15.
The sun rises. Thus begins a new day in the merry journey of the warrior Jagdish and his loyal companion Forge Master Gutch and their team of hard-working pack animals.
The big man sat up, stretched his arms, and then twisted his head back and forth to pop his neck. He groaned.
Oh, I never thought I'd miss sleeping in a swamper's hut. But deerskins make for a softer bed than this hard ground.
It's not been so bad since it quit raining on us, Jagdish replied, as Gutch wandered into the bushes to relieve himself.
Walk further out. You'll scare the donkeys.
Only because I piss like unto a mighty waterfall, Gutch shouted back.
A minute later, he wandered back into camp, yawning and taking in the trees around them.
What a beautiful day.
Jagdish looked up from the breakfast he'd been preparing over their small campfire. He'd taken a small copper frying pan from the wild men, and it had proven remarkably useful. There was a surprising amount of food available in this region, once the wild men had taught him where to look for it.
You're in a fine mood this morning, Gutch. Despite having pointy rocks sticking in me kidneys and spine all night, that's because, by the light of dawn, this place looks to be far more forest than swamp, which means we're that much closer to civilization. I tell you that civilization is a damn fine thing when you are wealthy men, as we shall both be as soon as we sell all that.
Gutch gestured to the pile of sacks and saddlebags they'd stacked against a tree trunk the night before.
There's enough demon parts there to keep us in wine and pleasure women until the end of time.
Jagdish chuckled. He knew where his stubborn travelling companion and partner in crime was going with this, because they'd already had the same argument every single day of their journey.
Do with your half as you wish, Gutch. But you know what I intend to do with mine. Donate it to Heart of Adal in the vain attempt of restoring your name, right before he has you publicly executed for riding with Ashok the Blackheart. A fine plan, that.
The worker walked over to their fire and then sat down on a fallen log across from Jagdish.
What's for breakfast?
I found a nest full of eggs while I was on watch.
Bird or lizard?
Jagdish shrugged. He was assuming grouse, but it could go either way out here.
Who am I kidding? There could be baby demons inside and I'm still hungry enough to eat them.
Gutch trailed off.
Do you suppose demons lay eggs?
Why would they do that? They live in the ocean, like fish.
A castless told me fish lay eggs.
Castless even eat those?
Gutch shuddered.
Fish lay eggs in water. So it just stands to reason demons would too, Rizzledar.
That wasn't the kind of philosophical pondering he'd wanted to start his day with, but it beat Gutch pestering him about his plan to return to his Vadal homeland.
Well, we've now harvested more demons for parts than anyone else alive, and I still couldn't tell you one way or the other how their insides work. Besides the bones and the general outline, they're nothing at all like a man or any animal I've ever seen.
Eggs, then, Gutch declared. Demons must lay eggs.
Hold on now. I didn't say that. You declare them to be like fish because they live in hell. But if Keita and the old stories are to be believed, demons aren't from the sea originally.
As if anyone sane would believe a word Keita said about anything, with his tales of mighty Rem Rowan riding a black steel ship down from the heavens.
But then Gutch stroked his beard, as if he were an arbiter reasoning through a fine point of law.
By that logic, though, the history say demons fell from the sky. You know what else lives in the sky? Birds, which lay eggs. You have me there, Gutch. Eggs it is.
Jagdish didn't know how the monstrous things worked. He just fervently hoped he never had to fight one again. They consumed their breakfast in silence. Gutch was a giant of a man, barrel-chested and solid, but like Jagdish, he too had fallen ill with the swamp fever. He'd lost quite a bit of weight, so wasn't nearly as ponderous as he had been. Living off what you could forage while walking all day didn't give a man much opportunity to be fat. Though surely Gutch would remedy that situation as soon as they were back in the law-abiding world. He often said as much himself during their daily march, as he listed off the many items which would be on the menu for the great feast celebrating his return. When they were gone, the two of them gathered the donkeys they'd taken from the wild men and started piling the cargo on their backs. Toramana had not been eager to send so many of his tribe's precious livestock off with two northerners, but one stern glance from Ashok had settled the debate. Gutch and Jagdish had taken a disproportionate amount of valuable demon, but they'd all had more than they could carry anyway. They had so much weight in magic that unloading so the poor donkeys could rest, and then reloading them to begin their journey anew, took quite a bit of time and labour. But the two men had worked out a system. They took good care of the beasts, because losing one of them didn't mean just losing an animal, but also leaving behind a fortune in magic.
You know, I bet I could find some trustworthy workers in Warun, put together a proper expedition, and go back to gather the bones of that giant fellow we left hidden in the swamp. Forget enjoying civilization. With those big old bones, we could buy civilization. You don't need to appease your old Thakur, Jagdish. With this much money, you could be a Thakur. That's not how it works. I worry I can't just buy rank and status, Gutch.
Oh, really? And what exactly are you doing way out here in the middle of bleeding nowhere with the world's most valuable donkey train, then?
This is different. Is it now?
Jagdish frowned as he cinched down another sack that probably had enough demon inside to pay the living stipends of 50 warriors for a year.
I'm not buying anything. I earned my place through blood and sweat. I'm using these riches to get back the rank that's rightfully mine, is all.
Men of honour are a rare and dying breed, my friend. Probably because you're all busy dying stupidly, while more pragmatic men rise to the top.
Gutch grew serious.
I am begging you, Jagdish. Don't go back to Vidal. I can find us buyers in Warun. You can build an estate in Karsawan or Sarnabat. We'll get you forged travelling papers for whatever destination your heart desires.
My heart desires my home.
Then your heart is filled with foolish sentiment.
My wife is there. My child I've never met is there. Get new ones.
Anyone else, Jagdish would have punched them in the teeth for that. But after travelling across a third of the continent, battling smugglers, demons and wizards together, Gutch was basically his brother. So Jagdish just laughed at the foolishness.
I'm not inclined to. I'm rather fond of mine.
His arranged marriage had been a lucky one. Normally, when a disgraced warrior was married to a worker girl to seal a contract, you couldn't expect much. But wise, supportive, beautiful and kind, Pakpa had turned out to be his treasure. Jagdish happened to love his wife very much.
Then create a new identity, settle elsewhere, and send for your baker's daughter. Pakpa is the same caste as me. We workers are practical. Trust me, she'd rather live in a manor in Karsawan than a widow's shack in Vidal.
I'd rather die than give up my caste. My son's going to be raised as a warrior.
No problem. You want to command again? No other house is going to turn down an experienced officer who shows up on their doorstep with enough banknotes to fund his own garrison.
I don't want to buy a new name. I want my old name back. I'm no traitor to my house.
Ah! Why have loyalty to a house that had no loyalty to you? The instant Great House Fidel needed someone to blame, they tossed you, a blameless man beneath the wagon wheels. Harter will take your demon, say, "Thank you very much, noble warrior. And by the way, I heard you've been serving as the right hand of the man who cut my mother's face off. Now, right this way to our gallows. They're the finest gallows in all of Vidal."
Jagdish groaned.
"For the thousandth time, they'll not execute someone who avenged the murder of the Coldstream guards and brought back an incredible treasure for his house in the process. I intend to dump a bag of bones and the seal of Sikasso on the throne room floor and declare that offence has been satisfied. That's what I'll do, or I'm not the warrior Jagdish."
"Bravo!"
Gutch started to clap as if he'd just enjoyed the finale of a play. The noise even spooked one of the donkeys, who brayed at him in consternation.
"They'll be so impressed, they'll certainly hang you with a chain made of gold."
Deep down, he knew much of what Gutch was saying was valid. Depending on the mercy or wisdom of a politician was suicide. Perhaps the worker was right. Perhaps the honourable path only led to a bad end. Jagdish just shook his head.
"You're not a warrior, Gutch. I don't expect you to understand."
It was going to be a long walk back to Great House Fidal.
Chapter 16. Ashok had ridden ahead to scout for danger and stopped on the hillside overlooking the coal town of Dakantar. It pleased him to see that his bloodthirsty Somsak had managed to not burn it down in his absence. That must have been difficult for them, as the Somsak had raiding in their blood. Half a mile away, the Akashani warriors' tents still stood, though they were now occupied by the Sons of the Black Sword. The flag bearing the three red stars over a green field had been pulled down, and in its place hung a ragged strip of black fabric. He called upon the Heart of the Mountain to sharpen his vision. It appeared his men had been busy, as a large number of horses had been gathered. It simultaneously offended him that his gang of criminals had taken property they had no right to claim, and made him glad that they had shown initiative, because wagons would be useful to haul their supplies and the weakest of their marchers. Even setting a brutal pace, it had taken Thera's pathetic army nearly the entire day to walk to Dakantar, and by the time they got there, their number had swelled to nearly 400. The plains were like a never-ending parade of castless fleeing ahead of the warriors' extermination, and Thera seemed determined to keep taking them in like they were homeless pets. Ashok was highly annoyed by this, because every sickly castless who fell in with them made their column that much more vulnerable. Their meager supplies wouldn't last. Hunting or foraging food sufficient for such numbers would only slow them down more. Yet, in another respect, Ashok found that he was actually impressed by Thera's deep sense of responsibility for others. It was a noble trait, though one she normally kept well hidden beneath a hardened shell of self-preservation. Either the visions she'd received in the graveyard of demons had put a crack in her selfishness, or more likely, she was driven by guilt because the rebellion she'd inspired was the reason the capital had ordered all of these castles butchered. Regardless of her motivations, her mercy toward the castles was certainly making his obligation to keep her safe more difficult. It was his job to make sure her newfound kindness would not be the death of them all. It was curious how you could take someone with a sense of duty and honour, and difficult circumstances could turn them into a criminal. But when given an opportunity, some criminals could still try to do the right thing. Maybe not the legal thing, but the right thing. There being a difference between the two, still being a new and uncomfortable concept, but it was enough to make him question the multitude of executions he'd carried out over the 20 years he'd been a protector of the law. Were all those criminals as deserving of death as he'd thought they were at the time? Or, like Thera, would they have tried to do good if given the opportunity?
Foolishness.
Asher cursed himself for letting his mind wander. Leisurely philosophy was for the judges. Ashok was a criminal, and he had criminal duties to attend to. Satisfied that there wasn't an army of angry warriors waiting to greet them, he kneed his horse and set off back toward the column. The white stallion he had claimed yesterday was always eager to run. He was truly a magnificent animal, easily the equal in strength and stamina to a mighty Zargar warhorse. He must not have cared much for his previous rider because he had given Ashok little trouble all day.
Good job, horse.
That name would do, because Ashok had never been creative in the naming of his steeds. When he got back, he found Thera marching at the head of the column, red-faced and sweating. The last few miles had featured a gradual but steep climb into the hills around Dakantar. In fact, since they were travelling from a swamp by the ocean to the edge of the mountains, almost every day of their journey had been, and would continue to be, uphill to one degree or another. Such were the joys of marching. Even though Thera could claim the highest status of their odd band, she was carrying a pack as heavy as anyone else. Thera's ever-loyal bodyguard, Murugan, was walking beside her with a bow in his hand. He saw Ashok approaching and shouted, "The general returns!" For security, Thera should not have been at the front of the column, but rather in the middle, where it was safest. Ashok had told her that a few times already. Surely Murugan had insisted as well, but debating with that woman was about as useful as arguing with a wall. Only the wall was more likely to give.
"The camp is just over this rise. The suns await us. Why are you on point?"
"Somebody needs to set the pace for this lollygagging gang of imbeciles," Thera shouted back.
As Ashok got closer, he realized the color on her cheeks wasn't from the exertion, but rather from frustration.
"You appear angry."
"Of course I'm angry. Some of these damned fool idiots won't listen. I've had 2 men get into a fight over a woman, and 2 women get into a fight over who was the rightful owner of a chicken. It turns out that every castless jealously despises all the castless from the next village over. They slow us down with bickering and whining. I break them up to make peace. They're terrified of me, and while I'm there it's all heads bowed and as you wish, prophet, until I go to fix the next problem and they go back to squabbling."
"Do you wish me to kill someone as an example?"
"No!"
"I already offered, sir," Murugan said helpfully. "As you should have."
A good bodyguard tended to unpleasant tasks so that the higher status person they were protecting didn't have to worry about it. As for how to deal with this issue, he knew very little about the management of castles beyond what he'd see their overseers do. The castles bargeman, Nod, had taught him that whipping them only made the castles go slower. But then again, Ratul had certainly known how to motivate protector acolytes.
"Perhaps a few beatings, then."
"Tempting as that is, they're scared and upset, Ashok. Hurting them more won't fix that. They're refugees. They need something to believe in, something to hope for. Keita would have had them singing songs by now."
Ashok might not understand much about life among the other castes, but he did understand discipline.
"If you treat them as children, they will remain children. You must impose order on them. Every man must have a place."
"Don't quote the law at me while we're actively rebelling against it."
"You have said yourself, you don't hate all of the law, merely the parts you find unjust. Then I would suggest adopting the parts which suit you, and quickly, before your disorganized rabble gets us all killed. But I did not ride here to discuss the politics of the castless."
He held one hand down toward her.
"Ride with me to the camp. The column can catch up.
Thera seemed torn as she looked at his extended hand.
They're a mess. I'm afraid they'll all fall apart without me.
If they can't make it the last few miles on their own, then they do not deserve you, and they should die alone on the plains.
Thera bit her lip as she thought it over, looked at Ashok's hand, and then back toward her ragged mob, obviously torn between duty and annoyance. So Ashok provided her an honorable way out.
You need to decide what to do about the town and the hostages. Such decisions are not mine to make.
In that case...
She took his hand. He effortlessly swung her up behind his back.
Horace snorted and stamped, as if to say that he'd never agreed to two riders. Whoa!
Thera had one last command to give.
Merrigan, you're in charge of the column. Let it be known I've declared if any of them cause any more holdups, you'll leave them on the side of the road.
It will be done gladly, Prophet.
Ashok nudged Horace into a quick walk. Once they were away from the column, he said,
I have no doubt your bodyguard will fulfill that particular command with great enthusiasm.
He's a good kid.
Murrigan's as faithful as Keita, but only half as obnoxious about it. He's like my shadow when you're not around. I'm still getting used to the idea of warriors being willing to sacrifice their lives for mine. But I've no doubt that boy would take a blade meant for me in a heartbeat.
When the Sons of the Black Sword had encountered the demon in the swamp, it had been young Murrigan who had become frightened and ran, attracting its attention. Though Ashok couldn't himself feel fear, he'd faced enough sea demons to understand why a normal man would be terrified of them. They were pure lethality, bound in near impenetrable flesh, walking on near unbreakable bones. And Murrigan had panicked. It had only been temporary, and he'd returned quickly to the battle, and from all accounts fought well. But as warrior caste, he'd be forever shamed by that lapse. Ashok wondered how much of Murrigan's devotion to his prophet was due to faith, and how much was compensating for his earlier failure. Ultimately, his reasons didn't matter, as long as he did his job.
That warrior you'd found who'd punched the Inquisitor and caught an arrow for his trouble will be fine, she told him. Disobeying orders to murder castless doesn't mean he wanted to join a band of them, though. So I had him dropped off at a farmhouse we passed along the way.
Good, Ashok said.
Because even though it was illegal, the idea of striking Inquisitors amused him. It seemed incongruous how he could now simultaneously respect someone for keeping one part of the law while flagrantly violating another. But it was what it was. It seemed getting away from the refugees had greatly improved Thera's mood because she said,
Come on, Ashok, you can tell this stallion wants to run. Let him run.
I didn't cross half of Loch to save you from wizards to have you break your neck falling off a horse.
Cram your obligation. I'm a daughter of House Vane. I can probably ride better than you.
He doubted that very much. As you wish.
Horace needed very little coaxing. Thera had to wrap her arms around Ashok's waist and hold tight. He found that he didn't mind the closeness. After half a mile at a fierce gallop, feeling the wind on his face, he heard a surprising and unexpected sound. Thera laughing. It was an honest sound this time, not the sardonic, weary noise that she usually made, indicating mirth. He glanced back over his shoulder and found her actually grinning, carefree, while her dark hair whipped in the wind.